Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and on this program, we are going to be dealing with the Aztec UFO crash of 1948. In 1947 and 1948, in New Mexico, there were several incidents that shook the foundation of what men at that time believed. All of a sudden, there seemed to be evidence of life in other places. Other planets far, far away. There were at least four crashes of UFOs. One of them occurred at a place called Aztec, New Mexico, in this unlikely spot of scenic wilderness. Belief that the human race was superior to everything else was shaken to the core. This is a follow-up program, the Aztec Symposium, held every year in Aztec. The 13th anniversary was something else. Lynn Buchanan, a noted and respected remote viewer, along with a cadre of others, actually focused in on the crash of 1948, and his results were astounding. First of all, let's talk to Janet Saylor, our special correspondent, who was there when Lynn made the presentation. Janet, welcome back to the program. And he had 11 remote viewers altogether. I wonder how experienced these remote viewers really are.
But of the people who worked with him, he said they had between 1 and 13 years experience, and there was only one person who had one year of experience, and everybody else actually had between like 8 and 13 years of experience. And that overall, as a group, this group of people had a dependability rating of 68 to 89%, which he felt was pretty high. He says each viewer comes to the task from their own vantage point. You know, that's why you have a group of say 8 to 10 to 11 or 12 viewers all kind of tasking on the same project, because it's kind of like the facets of a diamond. You know, depending upon which direction you're coming at it from, it could look a little bit different. And so they get a whole lot more information that way from people, and they can piece it together and make it work a whole lot better for them. So he explained all of that first, and he said that in this particular program, they never actually asked, was there a crash? And so, but they never in any way put that into any of their questions or gave them any hint at all. And he said that there's really, he sort of apologized. He said that he didn't feel, in retrospect, he didn't feel that they had really asked the questions as well as they could have. And that, but that he was very happy with the responses that they got, and he would, you know, he says more detailed tasking is needed on these things because they got so many really good responses, and they can now parse them out and get more and more and more detailed information, including things as detailed as like the size of the saucer that this one person saw. He said we can keep sending people in with new tasking instructions, and at some point we can end up with it, you know, to the square millimeter, how big that thing was. And I thought it was pretty, really, very, very fascinating.
Janet, we really appreciate you going into Aztec and covering this for us. In our previous program, which people can hear, it's right here on this page, we did it the night before Lynn made his presentation on Saturday. And you had just received the written report from Lynn. He was nice enough to give it to us. And it was a little confusing. But I think that's because they tasked these remote viewers not only about the crash, but where was the wreckage taken. So I think we got a little of that mixed in there.
Well, I thought they were looking at the actual crash or whatever, but they were actually seeing where the materials were taken once the crash had happened and once they were able to get it onto trucks and whatnot. So those descriptions that I read to you last night about what people saw in terms of boxes, you know, a cube-like box and a campus-like setting and things like that, now he said that made perfect sense to them in the context of things, because that was the way they were tasking them. And, oh, and here's some more interesting things. Well, you know, do you remember when we talked about people seeing the woman? Yeah, they each saw a woman, and they described her very similarly in each case, and they saw dogs, or they saw the animals. Well, according to Lynn, it is typical for remote viewers to view aliens, to view extraterrestrials as either women or dogs. That just blew me away.
Yeah, when you first got the report, you and I spent a little time speculating on where they took the wreckage, where this place might be.
And, of course, my first thought was that some of this stuff could have been Dulce, and I still think that actually one of those answers referred to the Dulce underground base. But, you know, I'm remembering pictures from Los Alamos in 1948, and to me, anyway, that looks to me like there's some resemblance to that, too. I would have to go and look at some old pictures again, but the ones that I remember seem to me that they would certainly work with the kind of descriptions that we talked about last night.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn suggested that maybe it was a university or some government installation somewhere here or somewhere else. Now, they did come into, they came to some very specific conclusions after looking at all this information. And I can give you those. There was an overview. He says, I'll just read some of this to you because it says it much better than I could even ever paraphrase.
Okay, fine.
He says, analysis of the session information from these 11 viewers indicates that the tasking for this project was probably not exact enough. And he admitted that right up front. But he said, this is a possible scenario based on the information provided. It doesn't indicate that this is the only possible scenario, nor does it prove that this scenario is more accurate than any other. So he ends up with an overview. A, this is what they decided. There was a large object low above the ground, which then went to the ground. The object was extremely large and was designed for transportation. It was of silvery gray or black color. So this is what they get. This is what they're saying they got from the remote viewers. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And B, there were people observing the vehicle who were interested, curious, and happy to see it. There was a coming at ya, and that's gonna hurt kind of attitude among those people. He said. He said there were one or more biologicals who were disabled or hurt, and someone was trying to help them but could not do so because of an inability to understand. There were teams of people in helmets and protective clothing doing construction and deconstruction, and these teams appeared to work in shifts waiting their turn. There was some kind of attempt at negotiation among the parties involved, but understanding was difficult. The negotiations may have ended in the unofficially observed execution of some of the participants. That was a tough one.
Janet, did Lynn go into detail about this execution of an ET? I mean, or maybe even more than one? I mean, what happened there? I mean, were we trying to put them out of their misery or something?
No, I'm looking through my other notes right now, and as I recall, see, I've got several sets of notes here. He said that apparently they could not. There was one woman, and when I read you last night, we talked about the woman who seemed to be kind of a policewoman.
Uh-huh.
And that she was in charge of getting something done, and that somebody had actually fired into this room, and that apparently is what this was all about, that negotiations just fell apart, and that the easiest solution for us was to execute this living being. And there were obviously several living beings.
Wow. Do you get the impression we killed all of the ETs?
You know, not really.
Okay.
I get the impression that there were several alive when this craft landed, from what he said and from what's in the report, and I get the impression that some of those beings that were still alive when the crash landed probably died, and that whatever kind of communication or negotiations or whatever was happening with this last living being, it ended in an execution. That's what I got from it. I don't know if that's exactly right, but that's...
Now, Janet, as part of the show, we're going to play an interview we did with Lynn, actually before the conference. And basically, this interview, the reason I'm playing it, it goes into detail about how I became a remote viewer and what the hazards are and what the advantages are and all of that. But before we get to that, you are convinced that Lynn Buchanan thinks Aztec, the 1948 UFO crash, happened, right?
Absolutely, yes. He said absolutely he believed that. He said the valuation, based on all the information that came in, was that there was a craft and that it did indeed crash. He said the valuation ended up meaning, saying that there were one or more EBEs who were hurt. And that at least one of them was executed.
And as far as you are concerned, it's still an open question. I mean, because we don't really know where they took the EBEs or the wreckage after the crash.
Well, like I said, he didn't. He had his own kind of ideas. He said that based on the information they got back from, he came up with a conclusion that it was some kind of university setting, or possibly, or that it was some kind of government setting, that it had kind of a campus that went with it. And that's where I came up with Los Alamos. I have a note here that says, looks like Los Alamos to me.
Uh-huh.
Because, and then I have a note underneath it that says, was Los Alamos like that in 1948? And I've been to Los Alamos a number of times and seen some old-timey pictures. And it seems to me that throughout World War II, the place grew, you just grew by leaps and bounds, and that it was pretty much a well-planned out little town and very neat and clean, and with you know, with not only bunkhouses for the enlisted people, but very comfortable homes and buildings for teaching and stuff like that for everybody else. I remember seeing black and white pictures that, when I heard this, it immediately came to mind.
Now, Janet, before we go to the interview that I recorded earlier with Lynn, you actually pinned him down on some news stuff. I thought something is pretty interesting, and we need to talk about that.
I asked him why, because he volunteered, he said they found Saddam Hussein. They found a whole lot, his crew. He said after 9/11, he knew immediately where he could find bin Laden. He offered to find bin Laden because I asked him, I said, if you can find Saddam Hussein, if you can find all these other people, why haven't we found bin Laden yet? And he said, the government doesn't want us to find bin Laden. He said, I could have done that within 2 or 3 days after 9/11, but they didn't want me to do that. And everybody said, why? And somebody said, exactly at the same time he said it, he said, because they didn't want him because there would be no more reason for a war. And that was when I pressed him, and I said, who is they? And he waved his hand, and he said, the government. And I said, what part of the government? And he said, I don't know what part of the government. I said, well, was it our elected government? Was it the president? He said, I don't. And he just kind of passed off and would not answer that question. So
okay.
I don't know if he felt it was classified and he'd already told us too much or what. But he was very specific about the fact that not only did the group that he worked with know where Saddam Hussein was, they have always known. See, I've been kind of in my own personal feelings that bin Laden probably has been dead for the last several years from liver disease or whatever it is that makes him so sick. But he insists, he says he really believes bin Laden is still alive.
Huh.
So whatever that's worth.
Well, it might be worth quite a lot, Janet. We are, I don't want to give away the secrets here, but on our 9/11 series that comes up in August and September, we're debating about getting Lynn Buchanan and his company to remote view all of that, what happened at 9/11. I mean, I don't guess we'll present it as gospel, but it might be something for us to use as a baseline on our investigation. Anyway, thanks very much, Janet, for covering this for us. We appreciate you.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a bunch.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
And now let's go to the Lynn Buchanan interview we did earlier. I pick up the conversation with Lynn about the last time we talked.
I know. I think the last time I saw you was at a...
Lynn, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a while. I think the last time we were in Laughlin together, 2 or 3 years ago, at a UFO Congress.
It was. That's where it was, yeah.
Let's get right to the remote viewing of the Aztec 1948 crash scene. Now, they came to you, right? I mean, this was their idea.
Okay, we have been asked to have remote viewers take a look at the crash You know, there's a lot of stuff out on the internet saying it's all a hoax and it's all fake and everything else, and then there are a bunch of eyewitnesses that say, well, if it was such a big fake, why did I see it?
Yeah.
And so they wanted us to have remote viewers take a look and just find out what they get. And so we haven't told any of the remote viewers what the target is. We've just told them that they are remote viewing an event and to describe what they see.
Now, if I remember correctly from our last conversation, you were kind of like me. All these remote viewers are spread out all around the world.
They're all over the states, and in fact, there are several over in Europe and a couple over in other countries.
So how does this work? I mean, do they remote view all at the same time, or how? I mean, explain
it. No, I just send out the tasking over email, and they do their sessions, and they send us the results. We compile the results and provide the answer in a report. We do that for companies, for corporations, for police departments, for archaeologists, and so forth.
You know, Lynn, I think our audience is always interested in the real story behind the guest, and yours is certainly an interesting story. You have a unique profession, for sure. Why don't you tell our audience, well, I guess, first of all, how you got started?
Well, I got started in the military. I was I was one of the military's controlled remote viewers, also the database manager, and wore several other hats in the military unit. Once I retired from the military, the controlled remote viewing unit and all that was still classified, and so I went to work for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And then in late 1995, they effectively declassified the fact that the military had a remote viewing unit, what we did and so forth. And so all of a sudden, they found out that I was the trainer. The public found out that I had been the trainer for the unit. And so I started getting in all of these requests for training. And I, at the time, was traveling 2.5 to 3 hours into D.C. every day, working a 12-hour day, and then traveling 2.5 to 3 hours going home. And it dawned on me that I could do this, you know, do the training, which I love to do, and not commute. And so
I guess you moved out to New Mexico, huh?
Well, I moved out to New Mexico a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm.
But and I still teach here. But, you know, I started teaching the public remote viewing, started teaching it to police, to businessmen, and so on. The controlled remote viewing is different from what people are calling remote viewing.
Well, tell me the difference.
Basically, the term remote viewing came about when they declassified the unit and the fact that the government had been using remote viewing. They didn't tell anybody what it was. And so there were reporters in the D.C. area that were traveling around, you know, driving around the D.C. area looking for palm reader signs on front lawns and things like this, and going in and asking Madame Zoltar what remote viewing was. Well, it very quickly became what everybody did, you know. And once they found out that it was scientifically accepted, because it is a scientific process, then everybody started calling themselves remote viewers. And so these days, the term remote viewing is the new age term for psychic. And you can find palm remote viewers and crystal ball remote viewers and all that. controlled remote viewing is a science that was developed in the laboratories out at Stanford Research Institute to do espionage work for the government. And so, I mean, you can already see the difference here.
Mm-hmm.
It is basically, well, I think the best way to describe it, you know how a lie detector can tell whether you're lying or telling the truth. A good polygrapher can also tell if you're guessing. And a really good, highly trained polygrapher, believe it or not, can tell if you're guessing correctly or guessing incorrectly, even though you don't know the answer. The reason is that somewhere in your subconscious mind, I guess it's a connection with a collective unconscious or something, but the subconscious mind seems to know the answer. And through training, much like a martial art, you can get a person to be so sensitive to their own inner brainwave workings that they can make a guess and basically tell whether they're right or not. And, you know, within limits of human error.
Okay, Lynn, let's get a little more specific here. I was in the Army, too. It's a big organization. So how did you get into remote viewing in the first place? And was this a mixed unit or just the Army or what?
Oh, no. It was, by the time I got into it, it was Army.
Okay.
And the way I got into it, I know a lot of people don't believe in PK, you know, psychokinesis, but
mm-hmm.
I've had, well, I was one of those poltergeist kids growing up, and...
When you say poltergeist kid, you mean you saw ghosts?
Oh, no. Things fly off of shelves and things
okay,
like
I
that.
Okay, I got it. A mentalist, you could make things move. I just think about it, and they jump off the table.
Yes, and, you know, poltergeist kids get a bad rap because most of the time the ones you hear about are the ones who are mentally unstable and all that. But the fact is that a lot of kids... have these poltergeist experiences, psychokinetic experiences. It scares them and they quit and all that. Well, when they started happening to me, I got fascinated by them and started studying them and started figuring out how to make it work. So anyway...
So you could really make objects move off the table and things, jump up and down.
I was getting to where I could do that, yeah.
Wow.
I was showing off for a cute little redheaded girl one day.
We have something in common. I have a weakness for redheads, too.
I tell you, Charlie Brown's life and my life coincide a lot. But I was showing off, and she was duly impressed and went home and told her father, the Pentecostal minister. And the next day, he and three of his deacons met me on the way home from school, and he, you know, just asked me a question, and by the time I finished my answer, he and his deacons had me down on the sidewalk with their hands pressing my face down into the ground, screaming for the devil to come out of me and all this other stuff.
Isn't that illegal? I mean, you're a minor, a child abuse there.
Well, I tell you, it scared the life out of me. And, I mean, this had always just been something neat that was happening.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, it was my soul going to hell for doing any of
Lim, that. Where did you live when this happened? I'm just curious.
Oh, I was in Bell, California.
Okay.
Yeah, out in California.
Yeah, okay.
And so, anyway, I tried to suppress it and tried to suppress it. But one time in the military, I got just flaming angry, and computers just started going out. I've always had this problem of, you know, a lot of people have problems of... they get around computers, and the computers start acting up and going crazy and all that. So it's not.
I didn't
uncommon.
Know that about people getting mad at computers and making the computers go crazy. That's interesting.
Oh yeah. And
so you worked with computers when you were in the Army.
That's right.
Got to tell me more about this, Lynn. I mean, you got upset while on duty at the computers and screwed them up. Huh?
It just started frying computers. Well, at the time, there was an officer there who was looking for people who could do things like this because the military wanted to set up a unit that would be able to fry enemy computers. And so this guy witnessed that, and so he told the commanding general of the Intelligence and Security Command, and the next time the commanding general was out in Germany where I was stationed, he came by and he talked to me, and he just told me, you're going to be in a unit. Well, and, you know, you're going to help us form a unit to do this. Well, he got me back to D.C., and Congress would not fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a remote viewing unit there in Washington, D.C. area, and I was in D.C. He had nothing to do with me, and so he stuck me into the remote viewing unit. And
at that time, did the Army call it a remote viewing unit or what?
Well, they called it Operation Center Lane at the time.
Okay.
And that turned into Operation Stargate. They put me in this unit. And when they first read me on to what they do, you know, what they did, I thought I was on candid camera or something.
You thought they were putting you on, huh?
Oh, yeah. I thought, this is crazy. The Army doesn't do this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But sure enough, they did. And
hold on, Lynn. We got to take a break. This is interesting stuff. Lynn Buchanan's our guest. We're talking about remote viewing. I'm Jerry Pippin.